Hey guys, we produce this podcast for no other reason than to have a positive impact on the lives of you guys, the listeners, by sharing the stories and lessons of some incredible business owners. If you'd like to support our show, please head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Your review would be greatly appreciated and keeps us going. And now back to the show. Hello, legends. Today, I catch up with Cub member Dr. Josh Wall, co-founder and medical director of Contour Clinics, a cosmetic medicine company that started just 5 years ago and has now scaled to 100 staff, 6,000 patients a month, and over $40 million in annual revenue. Josh shared his incredible story as we discussed beauty, vanity, and confidence, his greatest lesson from rapidly scaling his company, and how to successfully grow and manage a team of over 100. He's a very impressive human being that I could have spoken to for hours. Enjoy the show. Hello, doctor. I've never started like that.
How are you?
Okay. But no, I am excited to have a doctor on because – so you were trying to explain it to me before, but it's me, so I'm confused. So you are not a plastic surgeon.
No.
Surgeon. You are a
– cosmetic physician.
Okay, what is that?
So I'm a specialist in cosmetic injectables. So lasers, Botox, fillers, anything like that.
Okay, and do you start out your career because, you know, if I was going to be smart enough to be in that space, I would probably start my career being like, I want to get into that because that seems to be where most of the traffic, like most of the business is. Is that what you did or?
No, I had a very different path. So I wanted to become a surgeon. So I spent my time aiming towards being a heart surgeon. So I spent a bit of time doing some training in that area. And it's one of those things, there's a very long road to get there. So normally what you have to do is you have to spend about 5 to 10 years unaccredited training. Then you get onto a 5-year training course. Then you do another 2 to 3 years of unpaid fellowship. And then you start your career. So I worked out I'd be about 45 to 48 by the time I started my career. So I thought, oh, it's a little bit too long for me. And it was like the light at the end of the tunnel just wasn't there. So a lot of us get into this, we've either done like general practice or, I mean, this is the other thing that we'll probably talk about later is that there is no specialty for what I do. So there's no accreditation and it's the Wild West out there. There's all kinds of people doing it. Some people have come straight out of medical school. Some people have been a doctor for 20 years before they get into it. So what we try and do with our business, we try and self-regulate. So there will be regulations coming in pretty soon, but currently there's none.
Okay, so
almost none. I mean, there's very vague rules, but in terms of qualifications, just you're a doctor, or you can be a nurse first day out of.
But
out
why
of
is that? Because, so, I assume there's a lot of regulation in the medical space, particularly in like plastic surgery and any surgery.
Yeah.
But is it because that your space is relatively newer? And correct me if I'm wrong, but like these days. Pretty much everyone I know would have Botox, filler, like whatever else you can get, like contouring and like, you know.
Yeah. It's newer. It's very, very new. I mean, I got into this space about 9 years ago now and there was very few of us doing it and there was no formal training courses. I mean, my level of training was pretty low when I first got into it. I remember that there was a training course from the UK and I'd done like a couple of small ones here and there. And I really wanted to do it and I saw it was like really expensive to do it. So I messaged him and said, hey, I realize you're in Sydney. Do you need a trainer for the course? I'm really experienced. And they said, yeah. So I had an interview and then instead of doing the course, I ended up being the trainer for the course. But I knew I got to sit in, they taught me and learn and all those kind of things. But that was back in the day because there was none of us doing it. That was like eight, nine years ago now. And now just every man and their dog does it.
I guess you could really kind of like thank Instagram for your whole industry because
pretty much, yeah.
Everyone had to look perfect all the time.
I mean, the taboo's going down. So there's not as much of a taboo around this anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said, most people, I mean, it's hard to come across someone that doesn't do this now. It's really popular. And from a business point of view, I mean, this industry grows anywhere from 20 to 50% every year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can be a pretty ordinary player. And still do well.
So what is important to you then? Because I would imagine if it's the Wild West, like you said, if I'm in a Wild West industry, the most important thing for me to be to do would be to ensure I am super credible.
Absolutely. You know,
I'm super trusted.
And that's what we do. So we have a model where everyone stays in their own lane. So we have plastic surgeons. So when we had a plastic surgery business, but when we did that, plastic surgeons doing surgery. We had cosmetic physicians doing the harder cosmetic procedures. We had nurses doing the lesser procedures. So everyone, you could, it's basically the kind of test that I run it through is, would I let my mum see any of my staff? And if they would, then I'm happy. So that's the kind of level I hold everyone to. And that's not true of the industry. It's just not. So we self-regulate. I run a crazy amount of education through our business. So I think I worked out I had about anywhere from like 600 to 700 hours of live teaching a year.
To your staff.
To my staff. Yeah. No other business. I can't imagine the world that does that.
Okay. You
know, so there's just so much teaching. So I run everyone through a pretty rigorous accreditation process. We really heavily invest. I've got a massive budget for education and training.
Okay. And Contour Clinics is the company name. I should have said that at the start.
Yeah.
How long ago did you start it?
5 years ago now.
And so kind of what's the scale? Because I understand it's grown quite rapidly.
Yeah. So to give you a bit of a background, so started 5 years ago now, just myself and my practice manager just staring at each other for about 6 months with no patients whatsoever. And then we started to pick up. We started to get really good on social media. We started to invest in things like Google Ads and search engine optimization and providing a really good service to our clientele and getting some really good injectors to come on board. And since then, we've grown to 100 staff and seeing 6,000 patients a month.
Wow.
So, yeah, within 5 years.
Like what I said to you before, the scary thing about seeing 6,000 patients a month is that there is that's a lot of time. You can't make a mistake.
Yeah, it's 72,000 a year.
Yeah, that is wild. So how do you ensure, how does one go about that? That's a daunting task. Like if I said to the team at Cub, hey, you have to make 6,000 introductions this month and they all have to be perfect.
Perfect. You can't bugger it up. It's, people wear their face every day, you can cause some serious, you can cause some serious harm to people.
And, so how do you ensure that though?
By doing this much teaching and training and education and I run them through a pretty vigorous process of accreditation and making sure that everyone's up to date. And we also all keep up to date as well. So I get key opinion leaders from all over the world to do private education sessions with us.
I imagine it would be more so in the operations, no? Not just the education?
Yeah, but I mean, look, the thing is we see high volume, so then we get pretty decent because anything you do a lot of, you get very good at. And then you're also doing a lot of education beforehand. It's hands-on education. So there's a lot of peer review. So there'll be a few of us watching each other to making sure that we're doing the right thing. Because what happens in our industry is that we're in a room alone. So I noticed that when I come out of surgical training is that it's a very lonely experience in that room because I've gone from operating side by side with professionals for years to being in a room alone seeing patients pretty much no one's monitoring what I'm doing. So we make sure that monitoring process happens. So it's something quite unique to us.
Okay, so you started the business with one clinic.
One clinic, yeah.
And there's 7 clinics now?
Yeah. Well, there will be. There's 6 now and then one more we've acquired, but it's in the pipeline.
Okay, so, you're going to have 7 clinics all in 100 staff in just 5 years.
Yeah, I was saying before, it's pretty interesting journey, this one. I had because it was it's a startup and I don't come from money, so I'd bought a house, I'd paid almost most of it off, and then so I sold it.
Whereabouts?
This is down in Wollongong.
Yeah.
So I'm from Wollongong. Sold the house, put everything I owned into it. I think I had $5,000 left in the bank, and then didn't take a wage for 2 years. So I did home doctor every single night, 4 or 5 nights a week.
You went to people's homes?
Home GP visits. That's how I made my income. Oh. So what I did is I'd wake up really early. And because I had to do all my own marketing as well. So I wrote about 100,000 words on the website. So I do 3 hours every morning and do all Google Ads and Facebook Ads and all that kind of stuff. And then I'd go and work from 10 till 5 and then I get picked up by my driver at 5:30 and we'd go and do home visits till 11 or 12.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty wild time.
Do you think that there is an advantage in your field in that, A, it's a very difficult field to get in. Like, I mean, it's a lot of stuff. Someone like me is not getting into that field because we're not going to pass the tests.
Yeah.
But so you're it almost like it filters out a lot of potential competition for you.
Yeah, because it's a high barrier to entry.
Yeah. Once you get there too, most of those people there, they're very like professionals. They want to be surgeon or they want to be – they don't turn around and be like, hey, I want to start an
entrepreneur. It's hard.
Yeah, like a business and scale it already to the size you've got. So it kind of is a strategic advantage, you know.
Look, it really is. There's not too many doctors that are businessmen and they don't have that mindset. A lot of them are clinicians and they love operating. They love seeing patients and I do too. But I've always had that entrepreneurial kind of itch that I wanted to scratch, you know. So I like seeing patients and I still do it 2 days a week. But I do love growing teams. I love growing businesses. It really excites me.
It's actually like two brains because, like, if you think about doctors, they really are following very strict procedures all the time. It's like you have this symptom. It could be this, this, and this. We have to do this test and then you have this, this, and this drug to – you know, it's very list oriented where like entrepreneurship is like, forget the list. It's chaos. You know, like there's no list. Like, you know, figure out and you jump in lists, you jump in pages, change books. You don't know. Yeah. You can't find a list. So it's a very different style of brain. Do you think that, were you more naturally inclined to one or were you one of these kind of special people that were
I've always liked the idea of business. No one in my family's ever done business before, so I didn't have any of that mentorship. Like I went to a pretty ordinary school and no one really did much coming out of there. So I didn't have any mentors and it was the part of the reason I joined Cub really because I don't have mentors and it was nice to get around like-minded people and get some inspiration because, again, like I don't have family in it. All my friends have gone on to medical specialties and, like you said, it's a very different brain. They have very different ideas and business is very different. I mean, unless you own a business, it's kind of hard to understand
to relate.
A lot of the struggles that we go through because people see the success. But, I mean, most businesses fail. Like, and there's a lot of pain to get to, you know, where you get.
I can tell you, the best way to fast-track a business or to increase your success in business or pretty much the one thing that every successful business person has in common and, I mean, I grew up a little bit differently in that I was fortunate to be surrounded by business people all the time, is they all had amazing networks and friends around them that that were helping them bounce ideas, same idea, hey, invest this, hey, you should do that. Like
definitely.
That is basically the most important thing you can do.
Yeah.
And I've always said it takes like the most special person to do like what you did, for example, or like what my old man did, which I've always said I wouldn't be that person. You know, I was put in the right – I was like when like great ambition like hit or had a baby with great opportunity and network and like that's – I came out, you know. Whereas some people when they start with – they don't have that network around them – nothing in business is normal and therefore everything is scarier and everything's more confusing and you know, it takes a really special person to push through that. But to fast track that or to ensure more success, the best thing you can do is go and like, well, kind of like what you did, but
you can't beat it. Yeah.
You can't beat surrounding yourself with other people
I don't like to reinvent the wheel either. So like most businesses, especially service-based businesses, they're, we're roughly doing the same thing on the back end. Like I've got a couple of extra things I've got to do with compliance and regulations and all those kind of things. But at the end of the day, we're providing a service to customers. So a lot of it's the same. So I just see what other people have done in service-based businesses and copy good themes from here and there and
go out of the way. What do you think were some of the biggest challenges you had not coming from a kind of business background or environment? You're going to maybe a rougher school in Wollongong or whatever you said.
Yeah.
What were the biggest barriers to entry for you mentally?
Look, I guess for me is I kind of fell into medical school and it's a bit of a story, but the reason I say that is that I went to a high school that we had 100 start and 4 went to uni. So it's a bit of a rough place and it's still the same. And people always ask me, like, oh, they must want to get you back. And I go, they couldn't give a rat's about me. And that's why only 4 people go to uni. You know, so and for someone like me, I'd never had aspirations to do anything. People that went to my school, we don't do that. So we don't become doctors, we don't become lawyers because we just don't do that, you know, because no one's done that. So it just was never an option for me. And I'd done quite well as an athlete and I'd gone to pursue that. And then when I come back, I started uni and I'd always been a hard worker. I'd always liked to work hard at things. So I got into uni and worked really hard and got good marks. And I don't think it was out of any special aptitude. I think I'm just really hard worker. And then I'd gone on to go into a better degree, psychology. And then I fell into medicine that I was at the uni bar one night with a buddy and he was doing physio and he said, oh, the medical school's opening. There's an opening night. Do you want to come along? And I said, I'll come support you because he wanted to be a doctor. And then I was doing a PhD in psychology at the time and I was hating it. I didn't like
psychology. Research.
Yeah. So I'd finished a psych degree and I was doing studying a PhD and it was a means to an end. I always wanted to be a clinician at that point and you have to do research just to tick the box. And I went there and this hour lecture at med school, they just sold me completely. I just went in. I'm a big nerd. So I smelt the books and I saw the lecture theater was all brand new and I was like, oh, that's really cool. And I thought to myself, I could go and finish this PhD in 4 years or I could study really hard, get into med school and have 4 years and have a guaranteed job forever. Like I'm just always very employable as a doctor. So I did that. I never learned science before. So I went and sat up the back. I looked up the uni timetable for all the science subjects and went and sat up the back for free and then would got through the entrance test by the skin of my teeth, like barely passed. And then because I'd done a lot of extracurricular stuff in my sporting and I did a whole heap of volunteer work, they really rated that highly for med school. So got in and never looked back.
It kind of just sounds like, well, you had naturally a good work ethic, but you also just kind of were willing to go with, you know, to take that next opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just, yeah, I'm not happy doing this. This opportunity's come up. I should try that. Like, I think there's a lesson in that.
Yeah. I always think to myself, and I don't think it's like, I like to think it's not arrogance, but if I've seen someone else has done it before, or a fair few people have done it before, I think I could do that.
Oh, like you're preaching to the choir. I was telling the team the other day because we've got that new tech startup Boa that we've been working on.
Yeah.
And the other day it was an article, Canva sells shares at 30 billion valuation or whatever it is. I was like, guys, if they can do it, we can do it.
Of course.
I promise you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, I was just in Monaco last week for a conference, a really cool cosmetic conference. And I was walking with my fiance around there. I've seen all these crazy boats and stuff. And I was just thinking, why not me? You know, like someone else has done it. I mean, look, it's a very lofty aspiration. I don't think I have the time to get there with what I'm doing at the moment. But I mean, that's the way I like to approach things now. I mean, if you shoot for that, and even if you hit 15% of that, you're going to do quite well.
Yeah. You know? My old man used to say to me, aim for the stars, and even if you miss, you might hit the moon. You're still looking good.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah.
And tell me, so, I mean, I think the beauty industry. Would you call? I mean, I know technically you're not in the beauty industry. What would you call your industry?
Well, look, the way I like to talk about it's confidence industry. So this is something that like people get a whole heap of confidence from these treatments.
Yes.
You know, so it's like you're looking better, feeling better. Like that's kind of how I like to.
So that's what you're selling.
That's confidence. What I'm selling, confidence, yeah. So it's a, you know, you might have something that's bothered you your entire life and every time you look in the mirror you think, oh, God, I don't like that. And then you come in and there's certainly some things, like a bump on the nose or something, that's a minute fix for me. And then that'll last you for 2 years. And that's something that you might have, like, especially young women out there, they might have, like, hidden from cameras in social situations. They may never want to get taken from the side profile. And I fix that in an instant. And, you know, some of that's a really rewarding thing. Like, I have some patients, you know, they'll cry straight after it. It's really, really
it's just such a, I would imagine being in business, it would be such an advantageous industry to be in because there's something so innate about the desire to, well, everybody wants to feel good.
Definitely.
You know, people all want to be attractive. Even attractive people want to be more attractive.
Yeah.
So you've kind of got this like limitless, like doesn't matter who they are, they're going to want the product.
Yeah.
And like, is there, how is that, does that make it a really easy industry to kind of sell in?
It's an interesting.
Or do you have like some ethical approach where you kind of, you know,
it's an interesting point you raised there because a lot of people, they will come in hoping to achieve something that's not an appearance thing. So they're hoping
to. I want to be Angelina Jolie.
Well, I mean, that's one thing, but they'll also hope they want to feel better, right? And sometimes you, when you dig deep, because part of our consultation process is ruling out, we're going to find out what your motivations are for treatment, because we want to keep you safe medically, but safe psychologically as well. So we want to stay on the, especially our business, stay on the ethical side of things. There's a lot of unscrupulous players out there that prey on those kind of things. But we want to make sure, one of the common things is, say for instance, people come in straight after a breakup. And you'll see, especially like women straight after a breakup, they'll get their hair done, their nails done, they just want to feel better about themselves. And often it'll be through some cosmetic treatment or a purchase online or, you know, a new car or something like that. And so you've just got to make sure that you're managing expectations really well there, because, and you, I can change this part of your appearance, but I can't change how you feel, you know, so you're just going to make sure that,
yeah,
that's addressed.
Yeah. Well, I think that's something that like, do you, is that something that's brought up with patients? Because that is like a really like tricky, like, cause you're walking an ethical tightrope in that I don't want to oversell you things, you know, even though like technically that would be good for the business, but would that actually be good for the person? It's kind of different a cub because like if I just introduce you to a bunch of amazing business people, like it's going to be pretty hard for me to like introduce you to too many amazing business people.
Yes.
Whereas you've got to kind of be like, you know what is the actual goal here? Like,
well, my goal is lifetime value. So what I want to, I preach to all my practitioners is this is about honesty-based selling, and this is what brings people back forever. So we like to go on a journey with people. So I can bring you in. We could do all kinds of psychological sales tactics and sting you out of thousands of dollars, but you're not going to feel good about that. You're not going to come back, and I'm not going to sleep very well at night from that. And that's not, my practitioners aren't, we weed out people that do that kind of thing, you know, because that's not good for the brand long-term. And you'll find that if you try and do that, they're not loyal clients. They don't like to come back. And it's just not a very pleasant way to work either.
Yeah. You know, I think nothing makes people more resentful of a business than feeling ripped off.
Exactly.
You know, even if you need to buy it because you're desperate for that particular product or whatever it is.
Yes.
If you feel ripped off, you'll be playing that money like you motherfucker.
Yeah,
you
know, definitely. Like you. And I say to people, I go, you don't need this. You want this. You don't need it.
Mm.
So if there's and I can give you suggestions as to what I think could make a difference. But then I'm also very honest as well. Like I'll say to someone, they might come in and say, oh, look, my neck, you know, they're in their 60s and they've done nothing before. And I say, look, if you're averse to surgery, then I can throw everything I have at it and maybe you get a 15% difference, right? But if you've got the money to spend and you don't care and you're happy with that expectation, then we'll proceed. But otherwise, if you're on a budget, I mean, don't waste your money. And then they're always my best clients because they'll come back and they really value that because that's very rare.
Or they may do like, so they may not do the neck, but they may then do, the things that you, can you, what are the other things that you would do?
Endless. You name a thing that.
Well, I only know three that I said, so fillers, like, look, Botox.
Fillers, Botox, lasers, threads, needling.
What's threads?
Threads are these, like, think of it like a stitch. They're made of the same stuff. If I was going to sew your appendix up or something, I'd use this PDO stitch, and we use them with barbs, and it's like a non-surgical facelift. So I put them in. It's like it's got barbs on one end, so I put it in, and then I pull it out, and the barbs stay in, and they kind of pull the skin up.
And it just holds your face up.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
They're pretty specific for a certain demographic of people, and
wow,
they're not a facelift.
See, but you've got to like baby steps, like,
oh yeah,
you know, like if I walked in and you were like, hey, I'm going to hold your face up with a string, exactly. I'd be like, whoa, like.
But that's where the skill and the consultation comes in. So we spend a lot of time around consultation, and a lot of the things too. I mean, it's hard to teach this to some of your practitioners. So a lot of that will come out in the interview, like just personality and social skills and those kind of things. Just being able to read the room.
And how do you like not as the practitioner, like? Are they just naturally not grossed out by, you know, doing things and like, you know,
in terms,
because like if I was there trying to thread a needle, I'd be like, whoa, I don't know, this is the business for me. Like,
look, we've a lot of us that have got into this. I mean, you don't get into this as a practitioner because you get a lot of experience with this stuff during med school and nursing school or whatever. So you either go into something that's like no blood at all.
Yeah, so it's actually nothing for you because you've done a lot of surgeries real things.
Yeah, and I've done some really big ones. I did a whole a fair few months in South Africa doing trauma surgery, Because I thought I wanted to be a surgeon. I was like, what's the best way to get experience? So I went over to Johannesburg and to give you an example, I've done trauma surgery in Westmead in Sydney and I saw, it's probably in 6 months, I saw maybe one gunshot wound, maybe like 3 or 4 stabbings. I would see like 10 gunshot wounds a night. I'd see like 20 or 30 stab wounds a night. It was like, it was wild. Like, and within the first week, I saw the whole trauma surgery textbook. Like everything that was I saw in the textbook, I saw present through the doors. It was
wow.
It was full on.
And so as a surgeon in that situation,
yeah,
where, like it is like this guy just came in with a blown up stomach.
Yeah.
How do you maintain your calm and stick to – like how do you follow the procedure? Because
there's a job to do. That's like it's really – it's you. I don't want to say you become cold to it. It's more you're just thinking about what to do. You know, so it's probably only till afterwards you might think, oh, geez, that was pretty full on.
Yeah, so it's an afterthought. Like maybe yeah. during the time you're not thinking, oh, this is a person I'm actually doing this on. You're kind of thinking like more, okay, I understand I need to take yeah. this and attach it to this. And then
and we've all got jobs to do. So like this is the trauma in particular is a team job, teamwork. So there's everyone has a job. So like one of us has to do like this this what's called a primary assessment where you go through like, you know, head, shoulders, toes, you know, heart, neurological, whatever. And then someone else is scribing, someone else is organizing, you know, the radiologist or whatever. Like, so there's, we all have jobs to do. So you're busy, you know. I mean, there's probably only one time where I've really, I mean, there's obviously some times where there's like children involved and stuff that's pretty rough.
It affects you.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, especially afterwards.
Because people aren't seeing that stuff all the time. Like only really a surgeon or like a,
yeah,
the army person, or you know, maybe a police officer in yeah. other countries, well, mostly other countries. Like, they're seeing this type of thing. But
it's, I've got to say, it's like it's been nice for me to come out of. Like, I don't deal with any sick people anymore.
I was going to say, you actually made the whole like needling the thread thing feel pretty normal to me now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like that person goes, they leave smiling.
Yeah,
you know, even though they're a bit battered and bruised, where it's pretty rough. I mean, I've had some pretty ordinary conversations in the hospital. You know, delivered some pretty bad news to people, which yeah. is not great.
I recently had my mum was sick for a long time, and like I had a lot of dealings with hospitals and doctors, and everyone was very like cold and like almost it felt unempathetic, and I never got upset about it because I understood that like these people have to have these types of conversations every single day, multiple times a day. And imagine if you had to feel empathy and if you had to feel emotion every time you had this conversation, yeah, yeah. you wouldn't be able to do your job.
And there's like, some people that just can't do it. That breaks them. You know, like you do have to become a little bit cold, unfortunately. And you'll see some surgical specialties in general. I mean, if you come across a neurosurgery registrar that's almost finished their training, I mean, they've been slogging it out for 15 years. They are the coldest.
Really?
Oh, man, they're just – I mean, these guys are doing 90 hours a week for 10, 15 years.
Wow.
You know, and they've seen everything, and they're just so much responsibility and such high stakes. Even with some of the cardiothoracics registrars I work with, very talented people. But yeah, God, they've done everything, seen everything.
But it does put things into perspective because, like, I mean, it makes me feel good because it's like I'm responsible for just making sure you got a good network. Yeah, you know, I'm not trying to like I might not kill you. You know, like we got to props to all the surgeons out there that
they're very special people, and that was part of the reason why I left as well because I had a bit of an epiphany one night where. I was on call. We had there's something called an aortic dissection. So where you split your aorta. Usually happens.
What's the aorta?
So oh, your heart. The real big vessel that comes big out pump. Of your heart and supplies all your body basically, and that's life threatening. Like you can't get any more life threatening. So you're basically running to the theater. So you want to try and get there in an hour or two from the time they present. And so I call my boss, and that's probably a 10-hour operation, 10-12-hour operation. And there's a part in that operation where the patient has to be basically frozen down to 18 degrees and all their blood stopped for half an hour. And your brain can survive that. So you're basically dead for half an hour. And you've got half an hour to fix that. And if you don't fix it in half an hour, every minute after that, they'll lose brain cells. So it's like the highest stakes operation you can get. And, I mean, all I'm doing is assisting. And usually there's another assistant ahead of me as well because I was still pretty junior. But when I called my boss – at like 2 in the morning, she was excited to come in And I'm like, I'm not that person. I'm not. And I could really honestly look myself in the mirror then. I was like, I'm just not going to be that. I feel like if you're a surgeon, that's pretty much mostly what you are. You know, you don't have much else outside of that. And they're absolutely brilliant people. My hats off to them because they love surgery.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's probably a pretty good thing that you realize in that moment that
definitely
that's not what you want, because the worst thing to do would be to continue down a path with that much responsibility.
Look, it's not good for me, not good for my family. Also, not fair on patients. You know, that was the other thing I thought about, because I'm like, I wouldn't want me operating on me if I don't feel like she does. Like my boss I had, she was amazing. She was just so impressive.
And so why can someone last half an hour with no breathing? Is it because they're frozen, their blood stopped, so they're not?
Yeah, so it's like when people fall into an ice lake or something and they revive them an hour later. That's because all your metabolism slows down to near nothing.
Wow, isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it's very fascinating. It's very, very cool medicine, but it's very stressful when they do those operations. One of the most high-stakes things, besides like clipping an aneurysm or something in neurosurgery, that's pretty full-on too.
And tell me, so in 5 years you scaled quite rapidly.
Yeah.
You went from really not having employees kind of ever to having 100 of them.
Yeah.
What were the biggest lessons you learned in terms of scaling?
Oh, geez. Right person, right seat. It's probably one of the big things in business. So like making sure like someone might be very talented, but are they necessarily in the right job? Are they doing the right task for them that suits their skill set? That's something that we've kind of moved people around and got better outcomes from that.
But to explain to me how you noticed that, because we actually did that recently at CUB with someone. It was the best thing we ever did.
Mm.
But how did you notice that they were in the wrong, like how did you notice they were in the wrong position?
Look, I guess it's just things get missed, things, you know, there's some tasks that require a higher level of organization and, you know, you're just not performing or where we like to kind of keep a pretty good oversight of things and you just notice things aren't going right. And the person's not happy in their role either. If you're not kicking ass, then you're not happy.
I think that's normally, like that's what I noticed.
Yeah.
That this particular person, like she's incredible. Like she's perfect CUB person. But I got the sense, she didn't even look that unhappy. I got the sense when I was there that she wasn't 100% certain about her role. Mm. And I did a one-on-one with her and she was telling me all the things she loves to do that she prefers, the things she likes to do.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think you're in the wrong role. Like I actually said to her, I think you should be in this role. Like,
definitely, yeah.
And so anyway, she said she kind of agreed. I can't remember if it was on the spot or whatever it was, but she moved straight away the next week. We moved her into the new role.
Yeah.
And all I get is messages now of how happy she is, how well she's doing.
Yeah, it's great.
Like, you know, and if as business owners or like anyone, as leaders or managers, if you don't have the flexibility for your team to be able to be put in the right role and if you're not keeping an eye out to make sure that they are enjoying what they're doing, in fact.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, that could have been an amazing person that we lost.
Definitely, exactly. The other thing is probably just hiring the right people. That's been one of the best things.
Yeah, but how do you do that? I agree, but
I mean, look, it's one of those things. You put a whole heap of effort into it, do a few interviews. You know where I tend to find my best staff come is through referrals, through personal referrals. That seems to be the best. I mean, so I'll hunt around in the space and then just getting, like you said before, getting a really good network. So I've got a very good network in the industry now. There's not too many people that I'm not friendly with. And someone's always moving here or here. And then I can, any of the people that apply to see me, I can call someone they've worked with and say, hey, what do you think of this person? So I can weed a lot of people out just by doing that, because there's some that look great on paper and then there's some, a lot of issues there. So that's been a good thing.
It's the power of the network. I mean, referrals, I agree. We actually just implemented something because we had a few of the team members referring new team members. So we're trying to grow and the team was like, hey, I know this person. Mm. So we just like mandated this thing where if a team member like introduces someone that we then hire,
yes,
that team member gets an immediate $1,000 like find a bonus. And then in the end, like 6 months at the end of their probation, at the person's probation, they get an additional $2,000.
Oh, that's great.
So like a little thank you, because you're not having to do the recruiters and like paying LinkedIn and like it's a lot of time saved. And the time it takes to filter all the applications and do all that.
And look, if you've got good staff, I mean, for me, I've got a lot of very good staff. I mean, then you've got like, you know, I'd have like 100 advocates out there looking.
Yeah.
You know, for me.
It's like a workforce army of recruiters.
Recruiters. I should implement that.
Oh, it's genius. Came up with it myself yesterday. Yeah,
no, that's great. I like it.
and how would you maintain culture or the desired culture with 100 staff?
Yeah, that's always been the hard thing, and it's something we've wrestled with a little bit, because there's been like lenient and everyone's friends and all those kind of things, but we're moving more towards now like an accountability. So holding people to account, because I think that was a thing that was, we thought like by being really lenient, nice guys and whatever, that was great for the culture, but I think it probably wasn't in a lot of ways. And now that we've kind of started holding everyone to a higher standing, holding ourselves to a higher standard, we've gotten really good feedback about it, because there's a couple of things we let slide here and there, and now that we've addressed them, I've got a lot of feedback to go, hey, good. Like, because everyone's watching what you're doing, especially in a company my size. And if you're letting poor behavior continue, you know, that's toxic for culture. Because like, hang on, you're letting that happen. You know, what about, I'm working really hard and you're letting that happen and blah, blah, blah. It's like.
That's a funny thing, because that's also something a lot of business owners will struggle with, particularly earlier on in the business, is that they kind of want to be liked by everybody.
Exactly.
And so it becomes like, oh, don't really want to tell them this. But that's actually the work, because your job is not to be liked. Your job is to be successful. And everyone with you should also become successful. And your job is to ensure or do everything in your power to make sure that the company is successful, so that therefore they can be successful. And that means you need to not just hold people to the highest of standards. You need to make it like, in fact, we want what did I say the other day, Laura, in the meeting? I was like, we only want A players. In fact, we only want the best. And we don't want just A players, but we want like psychopaths that are addicted to achieving great things and building this great company that's doing amazing things to the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And when people hear you say that, they're like, you know what? Like I do, because not everyone is born with like, I want to achieve something great. But when people come part of something and they're like, holy shit, you know what? I can achieve something great. And this is a place I can actually do that. And I've got the motivation. I've been given the direction. I know what's expected of me to be on this team.
Yes.
You know, I think people actually like that, because it's easier for them to understand this is how I fit in here. You know, and humans all want to belong.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's how they know this is how I belong. In this community, if that is the community culture that they want.
Yeah.
If it's not, then you should definitely leave. But if it is, then it's kind of like Cub. You know, we induct the members so that they understand this is what it means to be a part of this community, and so you know what's expected to be part of this community, and it makes it easier to then build strong relationships and connections with fellow members to help each other, even if you might have just met each other, or you know, like it's about being direct. It's about doing the opposite to – what's the word you said? It's about being the opposite of lenient.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you raised the point before about being liked. I mean, there's a really good book, I think Patrick Lencioni written, and it's The Five Temptations of a CEO, and one of them is popularity over accountability. So, and that touches on that perfectly, and it's something we all, like, as business leaders, have to watch out for, because it's very tempting to kind of want to be liked in the business. But it's just you're not going to achieve anything doing that.
Because that's human nature. Definitely. Like I always think like everyone wants to be liked. I don't want anyone not to like me. Like that no one's ever said, I hope that person hates me. Like even if you hate them, you kind of want them to like you. You know? But have you ever had a situation really tough, you know, happen within the team? Like again, you're dealing with big numbers because you've got 6,000 patients a month. You've got 100 people to look after as a team. There's a lot of numbers you're dealing with.
Look, there's always issues. I mean, people are people, you know, so people are going to go through all kinds of general stuff. They go, you know, deaths, divorces, marriages, kids, you know, all that normal stuff happens. You've got to deal with that when it arises. And then you're going to have people steal from you. You're going to have, especially like in my industry, like stealing patients and lying to you. And
So you know, what, like would they move? Yeah, they set up company, so or they set up a company.
I had one that had set up her own company, and then had decided to message all. So set it up kind of in secret, and then message all the patients on her book in when she was working for me, and say, "Come to me over here. I'll give you a discount, and they'll give you your deposit back." You know, like doing just dodgy, weird stuff like that. Another guy did something like that, and it's like I'd really taken the guy under my wing. Like I'd trained him up. He didn't dress very well, so I took him to my tailor and got him like all nice suits and stuff. And like really, but like it's just human nature, man. People will. I've learned to not take it too personally. It just happens, I guess. I've had it happen so many times now, where you just think, God, why did you do that?
Yeah, yeah. It's but you know. When it's kind of like when you are interviewing someone to hire them and they start talking shit about their ex-employer.
Yes.
You know, I'm like, man, even if your ex-employer was a jackass, I don't care because now I don't trust you.
No.
Because what if they're not a jackass you go talk about me after. So I was like, you're out of the picture.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same thing if you know, one of your ex-staff set up their own injectable clinic and then emailed all the patients from your thing, like, you're being a bit dodgy, like, hey, I'll give you a discount. And like, if I was one of the patients, I'd be like, I don't really think, like, maybe the dodgy patients would be like, yeah, Matt, go over there. But they'll do that to the person again and move to the next person.
They will, they're not loyal. Yeah.
But really, people that have like, people that work with each other that share the same values, I think would be, look, while that 15% might be like kind of beneficial right now, I don't think it's worth changing a company from a company that I currently trust and know.
Exactly.
And I think like the best thing to do is like the best company will win. Like, you know, it's if you're great, they just kind of stay.
I saw that it's just the long game. Like there's a lot of people that do silly stuff for short-term gains, but we're on it for the long haul.
Yeah, business is a wild space, isn't it?
It's a wild space. It's a cool space, man. I never do anything different. I mean, I would take a tenth of my salary to I could be offered 10 times what I get offered now to work for someone else. I'd never take it.
You can't do it. It's
never
impossible.
Work for anyone else anymore. I just love it. I really love it.
Yeah, it's so funny though because it's worse. Like
it's so much worse.
Yeah, okay, I'm not technically working for someone, but I actually am because now I'm working for my staff and I'm working for all these clients and like plus then I'm working for my family and I have to work for myself, which is like all this built up self-pressure and also self-hate and self-love and so like you've got all these self feelings happening.
Of course, yeah.
And like really you're actually worse off and it's harder.
I mean, I'm our lowest paid doctor.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to scale and I'm growing. I'm like, you know, I've got different aspirations. So
in addition to having all the stresses and the additional problems.
Yeah. I mean, I'm go on holiday. No, there's no holiday.
Isn't it weird then? Once you then have a business, you never want to go back. So it's like, it's weird because it's really hard. And
we're choosing when we work. You know, really, even though we're working probably harder because I come out of surgery and I'm like, oh, I'll be able to work less. I worked more. I was doing like I was sleeping 5 hours a night and like if I wasn't sleeping, I was working, you know. But,
is that when you were doing surgery?
That was when I come out of surgery. With the surgery, at least I, you know, probably had seven, eight hours break a day at least. You know, probably a little bit more.
And well, nothing would be worse than someone opening up my aorta and having 2 hours sleep. That would that would suck.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like I worked harder when I come out, but I was in charge. I chose that I was working.
I think it's a feeling of ownership.
It is.
Like of yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
Or, no, not even of yourself. It's of your destiny.
Yeah.
You know, like I own my destiny. I hate swearing in the podcast. If I screw this up.
Yeah.
Do you know when it happens too? I always say to Laura, it's when I talk to other young men, like that every time, like if it's an older gentleman, a woman, and I never swear. And then a young guy walks in and all of a sudden every second word I start swearing. And I'm always like, why do I?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, nothing makes you realize the bad habits you have in speaking and the annoying things you do, like having your own podcast.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it's wild. But I think it's a feeling of like owning your destiny. Like if I'm going to fail, I failed and I can't blame someone else for that.
No.
But if I win, I won.
Definitely. You know? Yeah, it's a great feeling too. Yeah.
It's kind of like being in a team sport and like the UFC. Like because you're a soccer player but you're also a UFC fighter because it's it feels like just you.
Yeah.
You know, and you hold yourself fully accountable to absolutely everything. If you lose that fight, it's your fault. Yeah. But at the same time, you're on a team and you're part of a team sport and your team needs to be great. It's like,
definitely.
I've never thought about it like that.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's a lot of us like the chaos too, I guess. I mean, I listened to something Dana White said the other day. He's like, because they're like, why do you still work? I mean, the guy's worth $500 million. And he's like, I just love the chaos. Mm. He goes, I got a war every day and I just love it. I wouldn't do anything different.
That's the other thing. When you're in business, if you're successful at it, I think you do need to love what you do.
Yeah. Like that's, you've got to hit so many setbacks and you've got to, I mean, entrepreneurship's all about resilience. It's just being how to keep coming back. Cause like there's so many things where it's just like, oh, is this worth it? But, you know, you love it. I love it.
I just love ticking
off goals. Like I can tick off 20 goals a day. You know, like I can make small wins every hour.
But so do you love the specific industry, the specific business, or do you love that you're constantly you have something difficult to achieve and you can constantly see yourself achieving?
Bits of everything, yeah. I can see progress every single hour. You know, I can see something happening. I can speak to an employee. Like we've got lots of different projects happening and I can check in with all of them and see wins. I can see, you know, or if we're not winning, we've found that doesn't work. Okay, let's do something different. I really like the industry. I mean, I really like chatting with people. I like the small. So I get to see, like, when I work as a doctor in this industry, I get to see like 20 different people a day. I like having the small talk, chatting, learning about people. I really enjoy that. And I still like to do the little skills. So I really enjoyed anatomy and surgery. But I didn't like doing 10-hour operations. I liked doing 15, 20 an hour operations, you know. So I get to do small things. Like I do some of these things. One of my favorite things to do is this earlobe repair. You know, people have got real big stretches in their ear.
Yeah.
So I'll reconstruct that and put it all together nicely.
Oh, so when they're young, they put that big thing in. They get older, they're like,
want to join the police force or something, and they can't have it anymore.
Well, because someone grabbed by the ear, like wrestle them down.
Yeah, apparently you're not allowed to see light through it. You see light through, you need to get fixed.
That's the rule. Well, I think that's a smart rule. Otherwise, like, if I was a crook, I'd be going around ear hooking police officers.
But it's cool. I get to sit there and I get to maintain that skill. I get to chat. It's a really cool job. And then I get to go from that to have a meeting with my CEO and, you know, talk through the business and a new acquisition and, you know, like investments we've got. We've opened a new venture, which is a cosmeceutical skincare range called Illume. Like that's doing really well. So look, there's just so much. There's so many little goals every day that I can just tick, 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 tick. It's just so motivating.
And I actually didn't know that you employed a CEO. So what was why did you do that?
Because we've gotten to a scale now where my business partner and I, like I'm a doctor. Yeah, look, I've got some entrepreneurial, drive, but I don't have an MBA. I haven't worked in all these massive corporates before. And similarly, my business partner is a pharmacist that has an MBA, but he's never worked in a corporate before. He's done a little bit of private equity, but we just thought that we're like, all right, let's put our egos aside. We need to get someone in that knows what they're doing, that can scale, that's proven to have scaled where we're at now in terms of profit and revenue to the sky. So this guy done it successfully before. He's very, very talented CEO. He's been a CEO for like 20, 25 years or something like that, maybe even longer. So he's been amazing. He's come and just tidied up the back end. All this like stuff, you can imagine with our growth, we'd been backfilling a lot of things. You know, we'd been just growing, scaling, like, you know, this process probably wasn't as good as it could be. We're wasting, you know, tens of thousands here or –
Everything isn't as efficient as it could be because your focus was growth, not efficiency.
It's growth. And now the other thing too is we want to eventually prep for investment. So we're getting it like properly ready for private equity to come in probably the next, 3 to 5 years. And so we can scale bigger. Like I have aspirations to take this all over the country and our skincare to take it all over the world. And we've got patents in every single country, trademarks and all kind of things. So we have very, very big goals. And for us to achieve those goals, we need A players.
Yeah.
You know, we need talent that have proven to do it before.
But see, I think that you just kind of understand the most important concept of life, which is you've got to surround yourself with the best possible people.
Definitely.
Like, you put together the best team, best people around you, best everything.
Yeah.
That's going to increase your odds. Every person just increases your odds that slight bit more.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, before we got the CEO, part of the reason we got the CEO is we had I kind of made a little bit of a makeshift board, and we had a contact that he was very kind to offer his services for a while. He was the ex-managing director of Hewlett-Packard for Australia Pacific, so, and also used to be the CEO of NEC Electronics. So, I mean, these are monstrous companies with, like, you know, I think they're 20,000 employees or something. So he's a very, very, he's like a professor of business, this guy. Like, there's nothing he doesn't know, you know. So I look at him, I kind of compare him to some of the old professors of heart surgery that I worked with. They're so wise. There's nothing they haven't seen. And
yeah, they're experts at what they do.
Experts.
They're really the best.
And when Alan come in, he just sat there, he listened for the first like couple of weeks, and then he just started making all these like really good suggestions. And it was just so awesome. And then he advised us. He's like, look, if you guys want to go to the next stage quicker, then you should get a CEO. And then he helped with that process. So he's been absolutely phenomenal.
We have a lot of like contacts with the private equity firms at Carbon. There's a few members that are in private equity that you should tell the team to connect you to them.
Yeah.
And did I read that you were a cyclist, or did you live in Paris?
Yeah.
Have you met Andrew Herman?
Mate, we were best friends growing up. I went to his 21st.
Oh, you know him?
Yeah, we're good friends.
Oh, I had coffee with him this morning.
Yeah, so that's
I was going to say you got to meet him because he's a cyclist
No. So
was that how you found Cub?
Yeah, so I found – it's a funny way I found Cub is you guys had run an ad on Facebook, and the only reason that it perked my interest because I was like, oh, it's Herman. And I hadn't seen Herman. I was
– He's a good-looking dude. That's why we chose him.
Yeah, he's a handsome fella. I would probably 10 years since I saw him. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then kind of forgot about it for a bit. But then as our business kind of grew a little bit, I thought I'll kind of investigate this a bit more.
You know what's funny? It's the power of social proof, or it's kind of like the power of influencers because, you know, they're influencers because everyone knows them.
Exactly.
So like if I see that influencer using that product, well, I know that influencer. So like, you know, through the camera.
Yeah.
So I'm wanting to try. I should try that. You know, pick my inch. Isn't that amazing?
100%. Yeah.
Anyway, well, then I don't need to introduce you to him. You already know him. Well, I could talk to you for like another hour, but we do have to wrap up.
No worries.
Do you have I could talk to you for more than another hour. Yeah. I'm just saying that another hour would be pretty easy.
No, that's cool.
Normally we finish with like a favorite book recommendation or something like that. Do you have one? Or a greatest lesson in business or
Look, the books that I like, I've been getting into at the moment is the one I mentioned before. So there's one I wrote down here for you guys. But so the one I wrote down was 33 Strategies of War by Robert Greene. So it's basically a it goes through all the biggest military leaders in history and all the big battles and stuff and all the trials and tribulations they had. And you can really take a lot of really cool lessons and apply them to business. It's actually – I just listened to it. It's about 30 hours of listening to it on an Audible, but I just listened to it in the car and just every now and then you're like, oh, that's interesting. I'll think about that. There was one the other day about, you know, not treating people too good or too bad, you know, just fair. And that seemed to have gotten the best result for some, you know, crazy successful military leader. Another ones I mentioned before, Patrick Lencioni's books. They're very small books and they're written like fables. So they're about 100 pages, but they're really tiny. You can probably read a book in about an hour and a half.
Oh, amazing.
And
they're the good books to gift sometimes.
Like, they're, you know, great. Yeah, I gifted my new CEO all the books when he first come on, and it was like one of them was The Five Temptations of a CEO. So it's The Popularity of Accountability. There's a few other really good ones there. There's The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. That's another
I've
really
read
good
that.
One.
That's kind of one of those staple books.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just they're so easy to read.
And they make sense.
Yeah,
like you can relate
do.
To it. Like, yeah, I
you do.
Like, yeah. Simple concepts are always the best ones. Yeah. For our listeners, if you want to get in contact with Josh, you go to cub.club for Dr. Josh. You can go to cub.club/podcast and you can find more about Contour Clinics there or get in contact and access some of his biggest lessons in business, as well as see our guest list of many, many people that we have on this podcast up there. We now have 201 people up there because this is our 201st episode. And if you want to catch up with Cub on social, it's at Club United Business on Instagram. It's also awesome there, so check that out. Josh, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For coming
great
on
to
me.
Be here.
It's obviously so great to have you part of Cub.
Thanks, man.
Hope you enjoyed the show.